KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I'm willing to bet that she will be the first Secretary of the Interior who frequently hikes Mailbox Peak in her native Washington state and who once spent a month climbing mountains in Antarctica, which is just not something I'd think of doing.
There's a section of that poster that says if you are having a baby, you may be entitled to additional leave on top of federal law.
When the dance was being developed in the street, there was a foundation that was being developed in the street. There was a foundation of this dance, basic moves and movements that actually created this dance.
Bryson Angeles talking about hip-hop dance as the massive monkeys do it. That's one of the stories you're going to hear this hour on Weekday. I hope you'll stay with us. We're also going to talk about medical leave. And you heard President Obama talking about his nomination of Sally Jewell as Secretary of the Interior. REI CEO Sally Jewell, she's been a banker. She's an environmentalist. She, as you heard, she likes to hike Mailbox Peak and other places. She'll be in charge of energy resources, land, wildlife, water, Native American issues as Interior Secretary. And with somebody with a foot in both the business and the environmental communities, she may be bringing voices to the table. We're going to hear a few voices and what they think Sally Jewell could do as Interior Secretary, especially as somebody from the Northwest. And with that, we start with Billy Frank Jr. He is the chair of the Northwest Indian Tribal Indians Commission, Northern Indians Fishery Commission, excuse me. He is also an environmental leader for many years, a treaty rights activist. He's a Nisqually tribal member. He's worked with Sally Jewell here and in Washington, D.C. I asked for his reaction to the nomination.
Well, you know, Steve, I tell you, I'm really, I'm proud of Sally. You know, Sally Jewell, she's a great lady. She's raised here. She went to high school. She went to University of Washington. And, you know, she's here. This is her home. Even though her dad comes from England and... But, you know, she's a great lady. She's an environmental person. You know, that's one of the things that we have a hard time getting in the door, you know, the natural resource people. And that's who the Northwest Indian Fish Commission is. But, you know, she's available to set us up with the big business people like Boeing and some of these things that we're wrestling with, fish consumption rate and, you know, things like that. We don't want to be fighting with the big business. We want to be sitting down with them, working things out and finding a balance.
You know what's
we're big business too.
Yeah, well, you know what's important about Interior, right? Is they are both in charge of wildlife resource and salmon, and also they're the liaison with the tribes. So you feel you have a good connection through the tribes with Sally Jewell.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, she's a great lady. You know, we've met before back in Washington, D.C., and, you know, she understands, she knows who we are, you know, our tribes out here, and, you know, I hope she makes herself available, you know, for all of us to sit down with her and not a big group, just, you know, we're the ones that go to Washington, D.C. for the tribes.
So Billy Frank Jr., what's the critical issue that Interior could take up with Sally Jewell in charge?
Well, one of the things that she could do is, you know, everybody says there ain't enough money to recover the salmon. In the Pacific salmon I'm talking about. And we're one big part of the lower 48 is one big part of the critical situation we're in. And with Pacific salmon, I mean, that's all species. And she could move money around to start recovering salmon and make that an order. And, you know, this is, you know, a healthy economy. Is a healthy environment.
Yeah, you know, she could.
They can go hand in hand. We don't have to fight over water, and you know, we can put a plan together here in the Northwest.
She could bring a federal focus to the Puget Sound cleanup, couldn't she?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she can bring it right straight to home. You know. And we work side by side with the federal government, and side by side with we'll work side by side with Sally, you know. And it's just it's so important that we stay together, all of us. And Sally Jewell is the person that understands that.
That's Billy Frank Jr. He's chair of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, also an activist and a leader in the Northwest. Tim Wigley is president of the Western Energy Alliance. Tim Wigley, thanks for talking to us.
Steve, thanks for having me. It's great to be talking to some fellow Northwesterners. I recently lived 10 years down in Portland, so I'm very familiar with your city. It's one of the best places on the planet. It really is.
It is one of the best places on the planet. Tell me something. You've been quoted a little bit. Your alliance has been quoted, too. What's the most important thing you think the Interior Secretary needs to take up in this next term?
Well, I represent just over 400 producers of oil and natural gas. We're based in the Rockies. You know, we'd very much like to, there's no question, you look around the country and see the states that are really booming economically, the states that have budget surpluses and so forth, and coincidentally they all happen to be energy producing states. And most of it's taking place on private or state lands, like you see in North Dakota and Oklahoma and Texas. But we have vast, vast assets of oil and natural gas on our vast amounts of public lands in the West. And it's not a question of whether it's there. It's a question of being able to access it. And so I'm hoping the new secretary will work with us to try to streamline some of the massive rules and regulations. We're not trying to get regulations reduced or eliminated. What we're saying is being able to give a little more certainty to energy companies to go in there and effectively, and it's not either or choice. You can protect the resource, protect the land, protect wildlife, and produce products. And we look forward to working with her on that, because there's no question it's one of the biggest economic booms this country's faced in a long time.
Now, you said that you can get in, you want to get on these lands. There has been exploration on these lands already, right? There are pads, there are roads through much of the West. What's been the policy over the last 4 or even 8 years in accessing those test sites, or even going beyond them being tests?
Very, very good question. It boils down to process more than anything else. You know, you can call it bureaucratic red tape. You can call it a lot of things. But an example, in the state of Colorado, which has probably the most stringent oil and gas rules and regulations in the country, if you're dealing with state lands or private lands, you can still get a permit in an average of 20, 25 days. The average permit time on federal lands for federal permits right now is 307 days. And in many cases, you've got companies out there that have waited 3, 4, 5 years, having to do multiple studies, multiple research. And we're not saying we want to do away with the research. We're just saying that creates an era of uncertainty when you've got literally tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars invested in some of these projects. So we want to have a high level of environmental protection, but a more streamlined level of the process of getting permits, so we can bring the product to the American public.
What does that mean, by the way, a high level of environmental protection, when you look at, for example, a very difficult issue coming up, the sage grouse?
Mm-hmm. Well, I lived in Oregon after the spotted owl wars, you know, took place back in the 80s, early 90s. But having worked in the forest products industry, and trying to protect salmon and owls and marble murrelets and so forth, I'm very familiar with the process. The oil and gas industry has a very, very outstanding record particularly on our onshore program of protecting resources. The sage-grouse has the potential to be as devastating, if not more devastating, to the industry as was the spotted owl was to the forest products industry in the Pacific Northwest. So we've been working with states trying to develop plans, plans to protect the species. We're looking at changing processes the amount of land that's available for development and so forth to make sure we do everything we can to protect the species that is sage-grouse. It's a huge, huge issue, and incoming Secretary Jewell is going to have a big say in what happens.
You know, of course, the larger issue about accessing the natural gas and the other resources on public lands is the question of greenhouse gas emissions and how the United States is going to transition to a less carbon-based economy. What do you guys want to hear from a Secretary of the Interior on that score? What's your time frame, I guess, for that transition, and what should that Secretary of the Interior be thinking about?
Another good question. I would like for your listeners to consider the following. While the oil and natural gas industry fully supports, we're kind of an all-of-the-above mindset that wind and solar need to play, and others need to play a key role in our long-term energy future. I want folks to understand that when you're looking at a 10,000-acre wind farm or solar farm and so forth, that is permanent impact to the land, permanent impact to the land where wildlife live and thrive and so forth. It brings forth, quite frankly, little energy at fairly high costs versus a oil and natural gas pad is a temporary impact to the land and a fraction of the land impacted, and it goes away. And what's given us this new energy renaissance in this country is not fracking, because fracking's been around since 1947. It's directional drilling. It's horizontal drilling, so that way you can take one pad and drill 15, 16, 17 wells from one pad, as opposed to the way it used to be, where you had 15, 16, you know, pads around a piece of property. So, you know, it's a unique opportunity to there's tons of oil and natural gas out there. Our country still is a fossil fuel-driven economy. Someday that may not be the case, but right now, you know, we're not in a position to get away from that as our main energy source. So, you know, we're hoping that Secretary Jewell can look at helping us with our processes the same way this current administration has helped wind and solar. Their average permitting process is 3 or 4 months' time on federal lands to develop a solar and wind farm, which, again, causes far more permanent impact to the land than does natural gas exploration.
All right, Tim Wigley, I appreciate you taking the time, giving us your thoughts. Tim Wigley is president of the Western Energy Alliance. We're a roundtable here of thoughts. President Obama nominating Northwesterner REI CEO Sally Jewell to be Interior Secretary. We're getting some thoughts about that. Sally Jewell, also a UW regent, so there's that aspect as well. Lisa Gromlich is Dean of the College of the Environment at the University of Washington. Lisa Gromlich, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for calling.
So I get to ask you two sort of parallel tracks here, and let me ask you about the higher education aspect of this. You have a nominee going to D.C., from the UW as a regent. What message would you like her to carry? What ideas would you like her to carry as Interior Secretary in regards to higher education and its role in interior policy?
Well, first of all, I want to say she's been a great regent. She has incredible communication skills. She was very, very effective in finding common ground among the UW regents on some pretty difficult issues that we were grappling with. And so in moving into this new position, I think, in addition to higher education, what she is going to be bringing is an appreciation for science as a foundation for decision-making in Department of Interior. That's something that Department of Interior has as one of its strategic goals. And I think Sally has been someone who has understood the role that that plays and has been an advocate for science. And so I think it will be a more subtle kind of set of attitudes that she will bring, less an advocate for higher education than for science and scholarship in general.
That's interesting, that notion of science, her carrying that notion of science with her. Anything jump out at you in particular from her time as a regent that prompts you to say that?
Well, first of all, she was critical in the formation of the College of the Environment, which is, was a very important way UW has amassed the kind of expertise that existed on the campus previously in smaller units and been able to mobilize that expertise to address scientific issues. So I think that that speaks to the way in which she really focuses on pragmatic results. How do you take an organization that's big and complex, not unlike UW and REI and now Interior, and actually move it forward so it actually addresses the most important questions in a timely way?
So, Lisa Gromlich, you are also a scientist. Mm-hmm. You do work on climate and ecosystems. What is the critical thing that the Interior Secretary can bring in the next 4 years to focus on those issues?
Well, I think it's interesting that Sally's appointment, in my mind, is yet another signal that the Obama administration is serious about taking pragmatic steps to address climate change. Pragmatic steps are always a little messier. They're not going to be based on dogma. They're going to be based on how we actually find pathways that meet economic imperatives as well as ecological and environmental ones. I think Billy Frank spoke wonderfully to this in describing ways in which salmon issues in the Pacific Northwest have demanded that kind of sets of compromise and pragmatic results. I think we can look to Sally to helping us use that kind of approach to solve some of these difficult issues.
I mean, she's got a difficult issue in access natural resources on public lands, Endangered Species Act issues, including what's happening with the sage grouse, which could affect that access. And of course, you came from Arizona, right, where you had all sorts of issues about water and how water is used. The Interior, we put a lot on the Secretary of the Interior's policy and programs. What do you think will be? You know, what would you think would be the biggest challenge for her in facing all this huge portfolio?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is going to be setting priorities and working with not just Interior, but the other federal agencies and entities to make things happen. And I'm, once again, have great faith that she's going to make progress. You know, I think of like her board service on the Mountains to Sound Greenway Trust. She, as I understand it, was an immediate past president of that trust. And if you think about that kind of effort, it was about bringing together diverse viewpoints to balance land conservation and urban development, two things that lots of times people think don't go together. So it's going to be bringing that kind of ability to create coalitions and to create ways in which we can move forward that I think will be the hallmark of her time at Interior.
All right, Lisa Gromlich, I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
She is a scientist. She is dean of the College of the Environment at the University of Washington. Todd Myers is director of the Washington Policy Center's Center for the Environment, Washington Policy Center, a free market think tank. Todd Myers, good to talk to you again.
Hey, good morning.
So what do you want to see a Northwesterner involved in business and the environment bring to the Department of Interior?
Well, I think she brings two things that are critical. One is that I don't think it's been mentioned is that she's an engineer by training. So I think she has, the reason that she has a grasp of science in that is because she has a training in engineering, but also as a business leader, I think she's going to have more of an eye on what works and what doesn't work, and what is economically sustainable. One of the things that we say is that if it's not economically sustainable, it's not environmentally sustainable, because eventually governments run out of money, and then you find that the programs can't go forward. And there's a lot of work to be done on Interior land. So I think if she brings those two things and keeps her eye on her training in engineering and economics, it will help her avoid some of the politics that bogs people down. You can never avoid politics completely in Washington, D.C., but it will certainly help guide her.
You heard Tim Wigley talking about the access to natural resources, the natural gas, and I suppose coal as well, and some other issues, resources. But against that, of course, is that larger question of climate change. How do you balance that as a scientist now?
I think there's a couple of things. One is, ironically, the United States has seen a very dramatic reduction in its carbon emissions per capita over the last decade. Actually, Washington State lags behind the rest of the country. Ironically, as much as we brag about Washington State being a leader, we lag behind the rest of the country. And the reason is that the rest of the country has moved from coal to natural gas. Natural gas emits about half as much CO2. So in some ways, natural gas is a very good transition to renewables of the future, which frankly are not ready yet. They're still very expensive and unpredictable. So I think that, you know, an engineering view of that will help her. But my general feeling about energy policy is that while Interior has jurisdiction over some of those issues, the decisions are made in the White House. Energy policy is simply too big an issue for, you know, one even cabinet member to make a decision on. So I think she will certainly have input, but I think the buck stops with the president.
You think that's the case with what is now the sage-grouse is a critical issue for many because it's on federal land, listed as endangered. It's going to affect the way exploration takes place on federal lands.
I think all of those things are true. There is certainly a very important role for the courts, and following the right process and science and Interior will have an important role in doing all of those things. Even if the president himself says, here's our policy, if it's against the law, he's going to get sued. So Interior will have to do its job under her direction to make sure that they get that process right. But like I said, I think those larger issues, ultimately, the direction will be set by the president. So where I think she can have an impact, though, is on recreation and parks and those sorts of things, which, of course, is, I think, one of her loves. And as ready as you think you are to go to run a bureaucracy, even being a CEO of a significant organization, when you get there, you are overwhelmed by the number of things, by the size of the bureaucracy, by all of the competing pressures. And I think she'll be most successful if she chooses a couple of things that she really loves and cares about and wants to change and focuses on those.
Well, she was on the Parks Board, and that board, the Northwest Conservation Parks, right? And that institution and others have said we've been shortchanging the funding for parks, so that could be something that she brings back.
And screaming to Congress and the president for more money is really not an option, so I think she's going to have to be clever about that. But again, her business background, I think, will help her in that. The other thing is that while the national forests are under agriculture, they're not under Interior. Interior does have forest land, and they say that a quarter of their forest land is unhealthy and needs what treatment to prevent it from simply going up in smoke and forest fires. Well, we don't have money for that either, but there are ways to make that merchantable, to earn some money so that you can earn the money to make sure that we put those forests back in a healthy ecosystem status. So I think that will really help her, especially in a time when, you know, begging for money isn't a very productive effort.
All right, Todd Myers, Director for the Washington Policy Center's Center for the Environment. I appreciate you talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sally Jewell served on the board of the National Parks Conservation Association, just to get that accurate. All right, we end up with Alan Derning, Executive Director of Sightline Institute, a think tank looking at environmental issues. Alan Derning, thanks for talking to us.
It's great to be with you again, Steve.
So, Alan, you have a Northwesterner going to Washington, D.C. What should she take with her?
Well, she should bring with her the Northwest values that she's manifested throughout her life. It's an enormous opportunity for the whole country to benefit from the sort of special combination that we at least strive to and strive towards and often achieve here of moving towards prosperity without sacrificing our environment.
All right. Well, you heard some other folks talking about the conflicts that a Secretary of Interior could be facing. Let me start with Puget Sound and salmon recovery. What would you like to see Sally Jewell advocate for?
Well, on the Sound, she's going to have a number of opportunities to help coordinate all the different federal agencies that have an influence on the long-term health of the Sound. And there are many. One of the challenges of the Sound is that there are so many actors involved that implementing, it's easy to develop plans, it's very hard to implement them, as we've seen with the several generations of institutions and organizations trying to protect the Sound. So if she can just provide some focus that will help to coordinate, that would be an enormous service.
You know, we have this person from the Northwest going, and people are excited about that, but are you concerned? Are there concerns that you have about either her personal background, engineer, businesswoman, banker, REI exec, or more broadly, concerns about what Interior can accomplish?
I wouldn't say that I have concerns. I would say that there's a giant challenge that she faces, And that is that the president has, in the first two years, put a fair amount of emphasis on changing energy policy and then sort of went dark on that question and, in fact, approved massive increases in leasing of coal, natural gas, and oil on federal lands and offshore. Then during the campaign, he scarcely mentioned the words climate change. In his second inaugural address, he made strong, very encouraging statements on climate change. In fact, he said probably more words about climate change than any other single issue, saying that it's time for us to take strong action and to, again, lead the world. So he's going to have to reconcile, the president needs to reconcile his commitment to climate change with his policies on fossil fuels. And a lot of those decisions manifest themselves through the Department of Interior. In particular, I'll give you one very specific Northwest example. The biggest issue about the long-term future of the climate and an important issue for the region's economic and environmental future is whether we will approve massive coal export terminals along the Northwest coast to ship scores of trainloads of Powder River Basin coal to China and other Asian ports. The quantity of carbon locked up in these fuels that coal and other companies are proposing to export through the Northwest is absolutely massive. It's actually larger than the Keystone Pipeline that's been getting so much national attention. And while the Secretary of Interior does not have control over the export terminals, the Interior Department is owns the land from which the coal is mostly mined. The coal is sold to coal companies at substantially below its market value. You can buy the stuff for about $1 a ton in the ground under public lands in Wyoming and Montana, about $1 billion a year of subsidy to that industry. And as I was saying, the administration's policy in the last few years has mostly been to encourage as much mining of that coal as possible. And so Sally Jewell, bringing a Northwest perspective, will be confronted with a massive test of whether she can stand up and change directions, use her business acumen, her banking acumen, to point out that we shouldn't be selling a climate-destroying public asset called coal for below-market rates when the shipping of that coal across the Northwest is not welcome here and is, in fact, a huge step in the wrong direction from the future we are trying to build for ourselves in the Northwest as a global leader on clean energy and the climate.
Going to crystallize and nationalize that discussion, to be sure, if she does that. Alan Derning, thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure.
Alan Derning is the executive director of the Sightline Institute, taking a look at some of the challenges and the issues Sally Jewell might take with her if she is confirmed as President Obama's Secretary of the Interior. This is Weekday.
The Ethics of Flu Research in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting La Bohème, the camaraderie, struggle, and passions of young lovers in Paris, conveyed by Puccini's sweeping score. La Bohème plays February 23rd through March 10th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
Forty-five degrees in Seattle with some clouds and some clear blue sky. Forecast says partly sunny today with scattered showers and a high of 47. It's 9:33. Just a bit later this hour, KUOW's Marcy Silman is going to take us on a trip to a new hip-hop dance studio in Seattle's International District. That is about 15 minutes away.
In the United States this year, flu season has been worse than usual in some places. In turn, public health officials have been stepping up their efforts to get people vaccinated. As of January, more than 134 million doses have been distributed. But what are the ethics and the ethical issues involved in researching the various strains of influenza? And why is ethics even part of that question? We take that up with Gaiman Bennett, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Biological Futures, a project of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Good to meet you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So why is there a Center for Biological Futures at the Fred Hutch Center?
Well, Fred Hutch and the U.S. government more generally has been thinking a lot about the question of how do we estimate the worth of the major investments we've been putting in the biological sciences. Almost all the biological sciences are funded on the promise of a certain kind of future, whether health delivery or the remediation of the environment, et cetera. How do you think about, how do you begin to imagine whether or not that investment is taking us in the right direction? So the Center for Biological Futures is a pilot project that was created to begin to pose those kinds of questions.
How interesting. So in terms of flu, what are the questions you're asking yourselves about the flu vaccine and the flu virus?
Well, the work that we do on flu centers on the controversies that have grown up around the engineering of so-called H5N1 flu. It's more generally known as bird flu. And there's been a controversy over the last year or so that centers on the question of whether or not we should be engineering bird flu to make it more virulent. As it is in the wild, it's pretty deadly, but it's not very transmissible between mammals and then certainly not between humans, transmitted easily between birds, but not to humans. The question, the research question has been, should you engineer it to make it transmissible to humans in order to understand what the underlying biological mechanisms are by way of which that happens? Well, it turns out about a year ago, a researcher actually did this.
From mammal to mammal, right?
He made mammal to mammal.
Transmission from mammal to mammal. Why did he need to do it in the real world? Why couldn't it have been modeled?
It's an unanswered question as to whether or not you actually need to create a virus that has an expanded host range, as it's called, an expanded host range that has not been attenuated, namely a virus that hasn't been made less dangerous. It's an unanswered question as to whether or not you need to do that in order to know what you need to know biologically in order to develop health preparedness measures. So quite specifically, this one of the two research groups, there's two research groups, one of them was led by a man by the name of Ron Fouchier. He's a Dutch virologist in Rotterdam. He was the first to announce that he had created a form of H5N1 that was transmissible between ferrets, therefore between mammals. His reasoning for that, he said, when pushed, when this began to become a controversy, was that if you knew the sequences by way of which this could become transmissible between mammals, then public health workers in the far-flung corners of the world where H5N1 bird flu is endemic could begin screening for the appearance of this genetic sequence, and then you'd be able to spot a pandemic before it happened, and you could begin to build up vaccine feedstocks based on this sequence. Now, the twist is, it's not at all obvious whether or not the sequence that he discovered through his engineering processes, we could talk a little bit about that if we wanted to, it's not at all clear whether or not that same sequence would ever be the one that actually showed up in the field. So if you had teams of public health workers screening for his sequence, you might actually be taking your eye off the ball. Now, that's a sort of in principle reason why it's questionable as to whether or not this research gives you the public health benefits that are claimed in relationship to it. There are pragmatic reasons, too.
Yeah.
We would love to have a situation in which there was a robust system worldwide where people with the right equipment and the right political will were screening bird populations and culling bird populations in places like Indonesia and Egypt and other places where you get a lot of bird flu. But the fact of the matter is that system is basically moribund right now. Moreover, the vaccine industry, by way of which we get our vaccines for each year, that's slow and cumbersome technically as well as politically. So a question that has been asked by a number of critics of this research has been, given that the infrastructure worldwide, by way of which you would deliver the benefits of your research, is basically moribund right now, why would you bring a virus into the world which some people think might have the potential to kill about half the world's population?
Didn't the researchers argue, look, we're in a lab, everything's hermetically sealed, there's no problem?
Right. So part of the controversy has been a kind of loop of polemics around the question of biosafety versus biosecurity. So it is the case that the researchers who have done this work were very careful about biosafety, and they were required to be careful about biosafety. The NIH and others who fund this research will only fund it if you're working in facilities. They're called BSL facilities, BSL 1, 2, 3, 4, relative to the danger of what you're working with. They'll only fund it if you're working in a facility that is safe in the sense that you've got the right filters, you wear the right suits, people can't get into the buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So the researchers who have been challenged on the question of whether or not the risks of their work outweigh the benefit have tended to respond, look, we followed the protocols, our labs are safe, people can't get into these facilities, and so on. But the question is not so much biosafety in that sense. The question is biosecurity. We live in a world, we all know we live in a world in which there's dangerous and malicious actors, not only out there, but in here, as it were. We're all complicated human beings, morally complicated human beings. And if the health benefits of this research for global public health are not at all clear, there's a genuine debate to be had as to whether or not you should be bringing this kind of virus into the current security milieu.
And we've all seen the movies. There's another question here, right? These guys, there's a lot of data involved. What they've done, what other people have done. Should the government keep that data? Or should the researchers keep that data out of other people's hands? Should the government control it? Or should it be disseminated?
This was the big question at the start of the controversy. So we're talking like fall 2011. This man, Ron Fouché, and then another group led by Yoshihiro Kawaoka have written papers showing that they can make H5N1 transmissible. The National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, which advises the National Institutes of Health in the U.S., who funded both projects, looked at the research, and they came to the conclusion that the potential dangers relative to security of publishing this work outweigh the promised or hoped for public health benefits. So they recommended at that time that you get redacted publication. Well, a number of things happened at that point. That's when you begin to get the swirling controversy. Not a lot of people were paying attention to this work, and even in the scientific community, until the question of government censorship came up and whether or not government censorship would have an adverse effect relative to the delivery of public health goods. What the NSABB proposed was that you could create a system whereby the journals would publish the papers in a redacted form, and the other kinds of information would be available through some kind of mechanism that researchers with, quote, a genuine need to know, could get to that work. Well, it's not at all clear how you would begin to set up that mechanism, how you would reconcile it with U.S. law relative to law in other countries and international regimes. The WHO has promised countries where H5N1 is endemic, from which they took the original samples, that they could get any of the benefits that came out from the work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when you first got a moratorium on this work, January 2012, the researchers agreed to a moratorium, a temporary voluntary moratorium. Part of the reason for that was to see whether or not a system like this could be put into place. Nobody knows whether or not that kind of system would ever be feasible. It's still sort of in the works. The U.S. government has now proposed basically two oversight frameworks for dealing with this question moving forward. Because keep in mind, the U.S. government was as caught off guard by all of this as everyone else. All they had ever required was in prior review of research, review before it happened, all they had ever required was biosafety. So they were just as much caught off guard by the biosecurity questions as anybody else. In any event, cut a long story short, they are now proposing some frameworks whereby you could identify in advance research whose results you might not want to be published and broadly circulated.
Cayman Bennett is right in the middle of this as a senior research fellow thinking about biological futures at the Center for Biological Futures, part of the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center. We get these emails, these pitches, and there's this talk that's going to take place, right? 2:30, Simpson Center for Humanities. You guys are going to have a whole bunch of people sitting around talking about these issues, figuring out what goes next. But boy, you're right in the realm of those science fiction movies, really, aren't you?
It feels like it sometimes. The thing that's important to keep in mind in all of this, and which I hold close to in my own work, I'm an anthropologist, so I want to pay attention to what's really happening. Who's really doing what work, under what legal circumstances, and so on.
Huh. Well, I appreciate you just giving us a little taste of it. That's very interesting.
It's my pleasure.
You can find out more. We have a link to what's happening at the UW. There are Biological Futures in a Globalized World, 2:30 at Simpson Center for the Humanities. And I hope to have you back. We'll talk about more of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:44. Hip-hop dance in Seattle's International District in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
The largest coal export terminal on the West Coast could be built near Bellingham. Find out what moving Wyoming coal through the Northwest could mean for your community. I'm Ashley Ahern, KUOW's environment reporter. Join me for a panel discussion at Seattle's Town Hall on February 13th. Details at earthfix.kuow.org. See you there.
Support for KUOW comes from For Your Eyes Only in Wallingford, locally owned for 26 years, offering frames from small independent designers and lenses for all prescriptions, including Transitions Adaptive Lenses. Open daily, including Sundays, with parking provided, and online at foryoureyesonlyoptical.com.
45 degrees in Seattle with some clouds and some sun. Forecast says partly sunny today, scattered showers, and a high of 47. When was the last time you wrote a letter? Not an email or a text, an actual pen and paper, envelope and stamp, honest-to-goodness letter. What does it mean that the old-school letter seems to be fading into history? Does anybody care? Do you care? We want to hear from you. That conversation begins in 20 minutes.
But first, we're going to talk about the art of our city. And Marcy Silman's here, just a remembrance of somebody important in the art of our city.
I do want to say that longtime artist and teacher Alden Mason died yesterday of complications from pneumonia and the flu. Many people were touched by him. 60 years as an educator and a painter, and lively till the end, 93 years old.
And right in the middle of politics at one point, right?
Right in the middle of politics about 25 years ago, had a work that had been commissioned by the state legislature, and some lawmakers decided they didn't want it in the Capitol building anymore. And Alden Mason and his fellow artist Michael Spafford launched a lawsuit to prevent the legislature from removing those artworks, and they lost, and those works were subsequently moved. Anyways, we want to remember Alden Mason today as we move on to something completely different. And Steve, you perhaps have heard of the Storefronts Project.
And seen them. I love them.
Right. The organization Shunpike, in partnership with City of Seattle and neighborhood businesses, tries to enliven business districts where there are vacant storefronts by putting artists in for residencies. And there's been all kinds of people who've used the space for studios or pop-up galleries, little stores. But I believe that this is the first time in this most recent round of residencies that a hip-hop dance school has been awarded a storefront residency.
Oh, great.
Down in Seattle's International District, the breakdance crew Massive Monkeys is operating a school called the Beacon. And when I heard about this, I had to check it out. So we went down to the ID. It's in one of the old hotels that have been refurbished. And two of the monkeys, I think they're Massive Monkeys always. I don't actually know if you can shorten it to monkeys. But Ronald Cabang and Bryson Angeles are the co-directors of this project. And Ronald was a little reticent. And so I was curious, and I went down and talked to Bryson Angeles about why Massive Monkeys would even apply for a storefront residency in the first place.
The partner who I run the studio with, Ronald Cabang, actually brought this to my attention maybe 3 days before the deadline to get it submitted. So he brings it to me and he's saying, well, we've been talking about doing the studio for some time now. Let's see what the chances of us getting this are. And in my head, I'm thinking, you know, we've applied for grants and we've tried to do these different things. This is just going to be 3 days of intensive work trying to submit this grant, because I know how much was going to go into it. And more likely than not, we're not going to get it. We ended up going for it anyway. He did a lot of talking me into it, like, yeah, well, it's worth a shot. You know, let's go for it. We submitted the grant, and then we waited a few months, and we heard back that out of, I think, 400 submissions, we were one of, I think, 70 or 80 organizations that got it. And, yeah, we were thrilled. But, you know, when they tell you, you're one of the organizations that actually get it, they say, you know, shortly after that, oh, but it's not guaranteed you're going to get a space. First, we have to find a space that will fit what your guys' idea of your project is. So it's kind of like, you got it, but you didn't all the way get it yet. Yeah.
So let me take you back to 99, and you're going to think I'm really dumb, but I need you to clarify, because I think of you, you're B-boys. Are there some girls in Massive Monkeys?
Yeah, there's we're most primarily B-boys, but there's two B-girls in our crew.
When I look at what you do, when I look at tapes, I think of it as something called breakdancing. Is that a term that you use to describe it?
Yeah, breakdancing is what I guess is most commonly known for our dance style or our dance form. Back when it was created, we were called B-boys and B-girls, break boys and break girls, because we would dance. We would go off and historically what they said is we would break to the break of the music, the part where a lot of the vocals and a lot of instruments drop out, and then it's just a drum break. I've heard different variations of the story and where the actual term comes from, but the technical term from the pioneers of this dance call us B-boys and B-girls, break boys and break girls, and we break. That's our dance style. When it became breakdancing was more of something that the media took, and they went with it, and they coined it this term breakdancing, which I don't, you know, I know it's not the proper term within our culture, but, you know, when we're talking about doing dance classes, for people to understand what we're talking about, we have to say they're breakdancing classes or break-in classes. So I guess all those terms at this point are all interchangeable.
There's ballet schools and tap schools and jazz hand schools, but I never think of this as something that comes out of a school.
This dance style was developed in the streets. This is something that a dance form that people latched onto who didn't have technical training, because in the 70s and at this time where this dance style came from in New York, there was no money in these families for them to send their kids to ballet schools. But it doesn't mean they don't like to dance, and it doesn't mean they don't like music. They are doing the same thing that other kids that had, more resources to them to be able to go and do these more structured things. But in that time, when the dance was being developed in the street, there was a foundation that was being developed in the street. There was a foundation of this dance, basic moves and movements that actually created this dance. And so when you talk about technical terms of there being ballet or tap or something, where there is a technical dance form, we have that in this dance form as well. And it was developed in the same way by innovative creative artists and dancers who create these moves. And so, yes, they're is a longer history of some of these other dance styles, but it's kind of a good thing. We are able to do that as well. And I want to go on to say that a lot of times it seems like there's some conflict between traditional dance styles and more street level dance styles, where, as in my opinion, being a B-boy, if at a younger age I would have been more open to taking jazz, ballet, acting classes, drama classes, all these different things than me as a performing artist, I would be a lot more developed, and my reach of the different job opportunities and opportunities to be an entertainer would be a lot broader. So in us creating this studio, we specialize in b-boying and breakdancing. We specialize in street dance. But as well, I want to offer these younger generation kids who are latching on to this street dance and this hip-hop dance, which is the most popular thing out there, it seems like to me, I want to also be able to encourage them and provide chances for them to do more traditional styles, to develop more well-rounded performing artists and dancers.
How did you learn?
I had a couple friends in middle school who had older brothers who were into breakdancing. They seen the movies, Beat Street, Wild Style, these movies that were coming out back in those times, or even they were even a few years old at that time, but I seen what they were doing. I was always in the gymnastics, I was in the music and dance. They brought me up to Jefferson Community Center and to Mercer Middle School, where I kind of just jumped in their after school program. I acted like I was a student so I can come up there and learn. So I would go up there, I would do their after school program from my middle school, catch the bus, go there, and then straight after the after school program, we would go to Jefferson Community Center. And we were taught by a crew called DVS Crew. A major member in that crew is Carter McGlasson, also, a.k.a. Fever One. He's also a teacher here at the studio, and he was our mentor, one of our major mentors who basically gave us this path and this knowledge and the true experience and the essence of this dance form, gave it to us and let us run with it, and this is what we've been able to do with it. So us learning from people like Fever, that's what makes us passionate about sharing the same thing with the next generation and doing it on a bigger level than one day at a community center. We want to do this every day, all the time, and offer it regularly to any youth out there. So,
show me like where you might start with a two-year-old. What would be the first thing besides having them run around, because that's what two-year-olds do, right?
We'll teach them some very, basic dance moves. Maybe go down to the floor and just put their hands on the ground and maybe just do a shuffle. This obviously isn't B-boy footwork. B-boy footwork is more in a circle, and we'll get more intricate. But being able to teach a kid those type of moves, or a 2 to 6 year old, there are ones who can do it, yes, but Mainly, we have to start them somewhere, so doing some tumbling and doing some stretching and doing some walking back and forth to music and doing some clapping their hands.
You mentioned earlier that there were set movements the same way that ballet or jazz have movements that have names, and I'm wondering if there's some that you could show me.
Well, we have something that's called the up rock, and that's mainly the dance that we do on top. So this is where we're finding our groove in the music. So if I'm hearing a beat, then before I even go down to the ground, I want to find my groove up top, and I want to dance up top in an up rock.
Is the movement coming from your core?
We want to definitely be balanced in our core, because that will allow us to put our limbs out in different directions. If our center of gravity is here, and I want to kick my leg out to the side, then if my center of gravity isn't centered in the core, then I'm going to fall the way that my leg is being kicked out. So.
Okay, so I'm doing an up rock. I'm hearing the beat, and it's coming out of sort of my hip, my center region. My arms are...
Fingers are snapping, hands are clapping. You want to carry the character in your face. You want to carry the character that you're feeling. If it's a music that sounds happy, then maybe we want to be happy and be funky with it. If it's something that sounds kind of more dark, then maybe we're going to be aggressive, and then we're going to go at our opponent, pointing at our opponent. And then when our groove is here, then we can go down to the ground and do our footwork moves. So
that's where I wish I had a video camera. Do you think it's something anybody can do?
Well, I think that a big thing that we want to share with people who are serious about becoming great dancers or great artists is the hard work and the dedication you put into it. Obviously, I've been doing it for 20 years, so I can just drop down to the floor and do that for you. But if there's somebody who's coming in and they have maybe a year of dance experience, we're not going to tell them, you're going to be a world-class breakdancer in 2 years. You're going to be a world-class b-boy, b-girl in 2 years. Like, we don't want to say that. What we do want to say to them is, come in, and if you're serious about it, we will share our experiences with you and help develop you to become as good as you can be with your individual personality, with your individual talent. And we're going to give you the tools where you can take that and put that hard work into it to get to that level that you want to be at.
You mentioned world class, and just turn around a second, because you've got posters from all kinds of, a lot of French posters here, mm-hmm. but these are places that Massive Monkeys have been.
What you see on the wall here is posters of events that we've won.
One thing that's really different about this kind of dance than jazz and ballet, those aren't competitions. They're not team against team, crew against crew.
Right.
It's the one thing that's really different about your art is that it's also sport in a way.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you pointed that out, because it is, I guess, what makes elements of hip-hop what they are. It's the battle. It's the competitive aspect that forces crews or individuals to try to be the best and one-up each other. And so with that direct competition, it's what really makes us elevate so fast. So yes.
Doing this, it's not that it takes it away from the street, but it is making it, you're kind of institutionalizing, in a way, something that is a street art form.
If we can bring some respect to this dance form, which sometimes, or this culture, which is hip-hop, if we could bring an element of respect and introduce people to really the true art forms behind what we're doing, then aside from us reaching the youth, that is another mission of ours, is to do that. Because sometimes it's misunderstood what we're about. You say street dance or you say street art form, and immediately people's minds go in this place where it's something street. It's rugged. It's maybe something that they don't want their kids involved in. But when you come in and you see it, and you see that the community supports us, and then we can share it directly with you in our studio on our dance floor, then that's a great thing. And if we are able to do that, then I think that's amazing and what we want to be doing.
That's Bryson Angeles, member of the hip-hop crew Massive Monkeys. Their new dance studio is open, offering a range of dance classes in Seattle's International District, 664 South King Street, 664 South King Street. So you can go there and you can find out more at massivemonkeys.com. They hope to have a big recital at the in March, and hope that temporary residency evolves into a permanent home. That sound comes to us from listener Alana. She and her co-workers sent us that sound. They work at Second Use Building Materials, a store that salvages building materials like cabinets and countertops. Okay, so what is that? People drop off building materials and they restore and resell them, all to reduce landfill. And last year, somebody dropped off a wheel of fortune. Now when people come to the store, they get to spin it. And the sound has become grating to some of the staff, but Alana finds it endearing. It reminds her of all the eclectic items they get and how much people enjoy them. You can see a picture of the wheel at our Facebook page, and you should send us some wonderful, fortunate sound to Sound of the Day, weekday at KUOW.org. And by the way, that flu discussion that's being had, the ethics of flu, that's tomorrow, not today. That's Friday, February 8th at 2:30, the free public forum at the UW exploring the ethics of flu research. And I hope you will find it on our website, on our Facebook page, and you'll get a link to that as well. Stay with us. More to come.
It's 9:59. The latest unemployment numbers and what they mean in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Service.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.